The vacuum of space could be more like a chemistry set than an empty void. This is Western Worlds. Greetings, and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissy, speaking to you from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Understanding how the very complex can form in the universe is one of the most fundamental questions that can be asked in science. Contrary to the popular belief, modern science is only scratching the surface of what there is to know. Recent discoveries of cyclic hydrocarbon molecules in space have demonstrated that complexity is possible in the vacuum. Professor Zander Teelens researches polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, at Leiden University in the Netherlands, and we spoke to him about his career and this research area. Let's go to the interview. Okay, Alexander, great to have you here. You're here at Western University. You gave a talk yesterday about astrochemistry, which was very interesting. So we'll get into that in a little bit. Why don't we just start by hearing a little bit about your background and how you came to be in your position at Leiden University?
I did a PhD at Leiden University too long ago to mention. Would make me dated. I went to NASA. I worked as a postdoc at NASA, then went to UC Berkeley for 5 years, became a civil servant at NASA, research scientist, went to the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, where I became the project scientist for HiFi, which is a heterodyne instrument which flew on the Herschel Space Observatory. And then I became the project scientist for SOFIA. SOFIA is a Boeing 747 and a jumbo jet, with a telescope in the back, about 2.5 meter telescope, which flies above most of the water in the atmosphere and then can observe the universe unadulterated. After that, I went to Leiden. I got my present position in Leiden, where I have been now for, I think, 6 years.
So how did you get started into astronomy? Astrophysics? What led you to that field?
One of my earliest memories was I grew up in the inner city and in Holland. And it's always clouded in Holland. It's always bad weather. But I went for a visit to the countryside, and it happened to be a very clear night. And I went outside, and I was just blown away by all the stars that I saw. That's a memory that has stayed with me. And then I grew up in the 60s, which is, of course, I'm a moon child. I grew up with the moonways, and it was one of the greatest accomplishments of mankind, I feel. We could go to the moon. So that inspired me to follow a career in astronomy, to be part of this. And so when I, for the first time, walked through that gate labeled NASA, I realized that I was working there for NASA, and that was a great moment in my life.
So how did you get into studying chemistry, biology, and so how do you commingle all these subjects to study how life matters here on Earth or how life is probable here in the universe?
Well, this is a very highly interdisciplinary field. Huh? So astronomy meets physics, meets chemistry, meets biology, meets geology, geochemistry, molecular physics. And there's no single person who knows everything about everything. So you have to work together. You have to bring all these people with experts with these different backgrounds and different expertise together. You have to talk to each other, teaching them to talk to each other, to listen to each other. And your last part is the most difficult part. That's a challenge. And that's a challenge that fits me well. That's a challenge that I like. It's a challenge that makes life interesting.
Was your experience working at NASA, because obviously you're European, your experience working with people with a different first language, with a different culture, that must be very helpful for you. Also, I imagine, a bit of a culture shock when you got to NASA for the first time.
Yeah, you could say that. I remember that when I told my wife, hey, we're going to California, and I'm going to work for NASA, you know, this position for 3 years, but we'll try it out for a year, and probably we'll go back then. Well, that's, after that very first day that I walked in, I knew that I was sold. and it has been great, because as you say, NASA is of course a very different culture. We will make it work kind of culture. That's not something that you normally encounter very much in academics. It's you're working together at a project. You're sort of part of the family. So if you have an issue, you call somebody up and you tell them, hey, this is the issue. They may not be able to help you, but they'll find out how to help you. And it's actually interesting, a side story here. When I entered NASA, I got my office and there was no furniture in it. And particularly there were no drawers where you could put store your files, no file cabinets. And that was because there was a new law passed by Congress, paper reduction law. Civil servants asked for too much paper, and they bothered people with too much paperwork that they had to fill out. So they were going to reduce that. And the way they were going to reduce that was by getting rid of the filing cabinets. Yeah. And so you could not order filing cabinets. And so when I called up, they said, yes, we cannot give you filing cabinets, but we could, if you asked for it, we could provide you with sideways storing cabinets. And the only difference is, of course, that instead of a long drawer that you pull in, it was a drawer that you pulled sideways out, and that stored your file sideways. And because it had a different name, it was not covered under law, and you could get it. Yeah, so and that's what I meant to get back to the main line. That was what I meant when I said that, hey, NASA personnel, you all felt part of the family. You all wanted to make things happen, wanted to make things work. And even if there were crazy laws stopping you from achieving your goal, you would find a way around it.
Mm. I suppose that's also a good explanation for the kind of attitude in terms of the main kind of work. So we hear a lot of stories, especially coming out of NASA, of people coming up against a problem they didn't expect and finding a unique way around it, whether that's with astronauts, as the Apollo mission is a very famous one, or with the Hubble, where there's a big problem, so they have to then go back to drawing board and figure out a way around that. Do you have any personal experience in your experience at NASA of those kind of situations coming up?
Well, I was project, not with NASA direct, but I was project scientist for HiFi, the heterodyne instrument on the Herschel Space Observatory. And there we did have a major breakdown. We had three things that went wrong, all at the same time. And so that sort of blew up one side of our instrument.
Right, okay.
The instrument is redundant, and you always make sure that there's not a single point failure. But before you start to switch on the other side, you really have to figure out what went wrong, and do we have it under control? Do we fully understand it? And so that's a place where you have a team then together who are going to look at all the issues involved, all the things that can have gone wrong, and trying to follow the trace of the whole incident and figure out what went wrong.
Mm. The Herschel mission was, by all accounts, was a great success for ESA. So maybe you could explain a little bit about your time there, what your duties were, and the kind of the information you found out from that mission.
Well, I was the project scientist, so that meant that I had to sort of coordinate the scientists, and there were 100 science co-wise on a mission like this, all coming from different backgrounds, different countries, so it can be challenging at times. And at the same time, you also have to fight with engineers, because the engineers want to make things simple. And to an engineer, it is actually the only thing that matters is when the thing is in orbit, it has to say beep, beep, beep. And the scientists, of course, don't want to have to say beep, but they want to squeeze the last ounce of science out of it. That is an interesting, challenging field of tension also, between the engineers on the one side, the scientists on the other side, and it's sort of where dreams meet reality. And so to navigate that was a very interesting job to do.
what in your everyday life does it look like today? So what are the mysteries that you're trying to solve in terms of understanding how we are here and how the universe is?
Well, over the last 20 years, we have discovered that we really live in a molecular universe. We live in a universe where molecules are abundant, widespread, ubiquitous. They're everywhere in the universe. And they dominate various processes that are very important, like the formation of new stars and planets, the structure of, the, of galaxies. And that's very new and very exciting that we have discovered because of the various space missions. I mentioned Herschel, there's also the Spitzer space mission, there was the ISO space mission before that. And my research over the last 20 years sort of has focused on trying to understand the role of these molecules in space, the origin of these molecules, also just the organic inventory. What kind of molecules can we find, particularly in regions of star and planet formation? And has that anything to do, is there any relationship with the origin of life?
So the first question is, what kind of tools are you using to aid you in that search? So how are you discovering what kind of molecules are out there in the universe?
Well, molecules have fingerprints. They have spectral fingerprints. They leave, they absorb only particular colors of light, not all colors. And so if you study the different colors that are emitted in the cell medium, then you can, from that, discover what kind of molecules are there. So one thing that we discovered is that large polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon molecules are very abundant. And polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon molecules are molecules that we all know very well. You know, if you ever have gone, visited your grandmother and opened up the cupboards where she stores her linen or so, you will have smelled naphthalene, the mothballs. That's a small polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon molecule. We are thinking about some of the bigger ones in space. These are the kind of molecules that you also form in car exhausts, when you have a soothing candle. And in essence, if you think about it, stars, when they grow old and they die, they eject most of the material back into the interstellar medium, and that material starts to soot, just like a candle. And so they are like polluting their environment. And this is one of the places where pollution is very good, because the pollution means that all these elements are returned into the interstellar medium, and all the carbon in our bodies, all the oxygen that we are breathing, was formed inside stars, was transported to their surfaces, and then ejected into the interstellar medium, where it floated around for maybe a billion years, and then formed a new solar system, a new planetary system, and in the end it formed us.
First, what kind of differences are there between, say, astrobiology and astrochemistry? And then also, how are they related? Because I imagine that even though there are distinct differences, they also fit together really well.
Over the last 20 years, we discovered we live in molecular universe. Something really new, and really exciting. And these molecules are everywhere. It's 5% of the carbon in the universe is locked up in these large molecules. So trying to understand this is a new and field in astronomy. And there is a clear relationship, of course, to astrobiology, because all the materials, all the carbon in our bodies, it all, at some point in its life cycle, all those atoms were part of molecules in space. And so trying to understand how we go from these large polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon molecules, how we bring those to the Earth, how we then transform them into molecules that have interest to biology. So prebiotic molecules, you know, simple amino acid. It's a very interesting and very fascinating and very complex field where astronomy meets molecular physics, and all of this has to come together.
Are you finding new processes here, or is it a case of the processes you understand in the formations of molecules or formations of substances, that what you're discovering fits into that? Are you discovering mysteries? How is this here? We don't quite understand how this PAH could have got into this position, or what it is, or what it is.
Well, let me give you an example. Jan Camé here at this university discovered the presence of large buckyballs. Buckyballs are soccer balls, but then on a molecular scale. 60 carbon atoms in the form of a soccer ball. And he discovered these for the first time in Spain, I think 5 years ago now, and their origin was a mystery. And then we discovered these same molecules, also these buckyballs, in the space between stars, where the densities are too low to really form them, adding one atom at a time. So that made us think of new processes. Well, maybe it's not a bottoms-up approach, where the chemistry is putting atom together one at a time to until you have 60, and you can form the buckyball. But we were thinking, well, maybe you start off with something that's really very big, you with a large particularly aromatic hydrocarbon molecule, and then you strip off the hydrogens and one by one, and you're left with a graphene sheet. And that graphene sheet then becomes unstable to losing carbon atoms. You may be able to form cages and then fullerenes and buckyballs. So it's a top-down chemistry. And that's a top-down chemistry that we hadn't thought of before, and that was really because these two discoveries came together.
How do these complex molecules help us try to look for life in the universe? Because we're finding a lot of exoplanets, and we are all trying to look for what we call Earth-sized planets in Goldilocks zone, basically where water can exist or life would exist. So how would these complex molecules transport in terms of understanding if life could be possible elsewhere?
Well, these complex molecules are too complex for life. I mean, life does contain, amino acids do contain simple rings, but not something as complex as a 50 carbon atom or a 60 aromatic hydrocarbon molecule. And so what you have to do, 5% of the carbon is locked up in these molecules, so what you have to do is break it down. Break it down, make the carbon available for interesting chemistry. And so that's where our interest in the chemistry comes in. So what processes play a role in breaking these molecules down to smaller molecules that then can be used to drive in biologically interesting chemistry? What kind of molecules would you make? And does that play a role? Does that sort of pre-select the kind of life that will evolve? And does that mean then that life will be similar on all planets? Because you start off with the same kind of process, delivering the same, working on the same kind of materials, delivering the same kind of pre-processed prebiotic molecules.
Well, there is an area for people to work in for the next N number of years, I guess. Yeah. There are open questions left.
So we've heard a little bit about looking for things far away. What about things in the solar system? Are there astrochemistry type experiments or instrumentation going on the space station, or are there plans for things that you can use, say, on Mars 2020 and the rovers? Or are you focusing mainly on spectroscopy type instrumentation?
Personally, that's what I do, yeah. But I think the field itself is, of course, very much interested in what happens elsewhere. You could mention the mission to the comet.
Yeah.
No, Rosetta. That's the Rosetta mission. That's, of course, a very exciting to be able to land on a comet and to look around and to search for the signatures of these molecules. You would do it differently. You don't do it by spectroscopy. You do it with chemical analytical techniques. But yes, that's certainly something that we do. We, the community.
Yeah. If anybody's listening who's interested in these fields, what kind of advice do you have for them if they want to go into something like astrochemistry, or what kind of technical skills do you think they would require that would be helpful for them?
Well, that's a nice thing about this field. It's so broad. It involves so many different expertises that no matter what your background is or what your interest is, you can contribute. I often tell my students, they may work in chemistry, but I often tell them, hey, you know, the process that you're studying, the molecule that you're studying, it's all very interesting, and you're doing this in the lab, but I'm sure that nature is doing it somewhere out there between the stars. And your task then is, before you can graduate, your task is to identify where it is happening. And that's, you see them think about that for a second, and then the quarter drops, and say they really get very excited. The things that they are doing have a relationship to things that nature is doing out there between the stars.
Okay. Thank you very much, Xander. It's been very nice speaking to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now for the roundtable discussion.
Well, that was a very interesting interview. Parshi, what did you think about Zander's career and his interests?
I had a fun time interviewing him, especially like when he was talking about moving from Europe to NASA and how like, you know, you get excited and it's like a different environment and how to get like accustomed to those things. Because I have been one of those. I've been transported from India to Canada and I kind of experienced the same things. I thought it was really cool. And he does astrochemistry, so...
I thought it was very interesting just finding out about astrochemistry. Mm-hmm. So... astrobiology was the sort of the new, in inverted commas, sort of space science when I was working at ESA in the Netherlands, and that was something that people were very excited about developing. And astrochemistry is kind of, or cosmochemistry, I suppose, is what it's generally known as, and that's kind of now asserted itself a bit as well, and it's also an equally interesting interesting field. Dana, what do you think about the interview, and was there anything that sort of stuck out for you?
Yeah, carrying on from what you were saying, I think it's really cool that we're branching off into the different disciplines. How a few years ago it would have just been lumped in as like space science, whereas now it's actually its own discipline. Exactly. So it just shows that there's growth in the industry, how these different disciplines can come to be.
And it also, I think, also indicates that there's quite interesting things specific things to look at. Like there are specific areas that could be separated out from what would have been called space science, and they have their own dynamics and so on and so forth. And there's enough stuff in there for people to specialize in, which I think is very interesting. What did you feel about his life experience, Dana, in terms of the moving from the Netherlands to America and so on? Does hearing that kind of stuff, does that interest you? Are you interested
yeah, in it's that? Definitely interesting for me. I'm not really looking to go NASA way, but I am considering like European Space Agency, so it's kind of the other way. Like I would end up in the Netherlands probably if I had a job there. So it's definitely interesting to see his point of view and how the culture can just be on its own. NASA has a very unique culture, so it's definitely interesting to hear his perspective on that.
Mm. And what did you think, Parshti, about the actual cosmochemistry? Your specialty is
massive stars. I'm just wondering why isn't it a field? Because it's like in the universe you have all these elements which are chemistry, and when you look at like, you know, the stars that I study, the Herbig AB stars, just young stars that are massive, but they're forming, and there's all these material that's around them. It's basically chemistry that's going on. You find everything from carbon to hydrogen to actual, you know, methane and other things in the universe, which is all chemistry. It's a field in itself. Depending on where in the universe are, the chemistry changes, the conditions change, and the way things evolve around it depend on the chemistry.
I always found it, well, not always, I find it interesting in the way that in space we're supposed to have this perfect vacuum that exists, and there's, you know, it's pretty much void and all this kind of stuff, and yet there's something going on whereby chemistry can happen. And to me, this is always something, this is a kind of peculiarity. It doesn't really sit well with the things I was taught in school about why chemistry comes about. And so I found that interview, speaking to Zander, very interesting to find out more about that area, because it seems to me that there is this kind of discontinuity a little bit in theorizing as to how those kinds of things can even happen, you know, because I got the feeling from him that he wasn't just looking at, say, the chemistry of very large objects where, you know, gravity is pulling things in and you can have chemical reactions. But he's also looking into, you know, the depths of space and seeing like these complex...
The interstellar medium where the chemistry still happens, if it's interstellar, it's between stars. Mm-hmm. But things still happen and they, you know, still exist. So the fact that we have... so much chemistry here on Earth is no miracle, because there's things going around in the universe that kind of have the same kind of layout and elements and, you know, material.
Exactly. So that kind of indicates to me that there's a lot more to come from this area. simply because it seems like it's a bit of a mystery as to how it can even come about in the first place.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by John Kissy and Parshati Patel and featured an interview by co-host John Kissy and Parshati Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured John Kissy, Parshati Patel and Dana Beaton, and our editors were John Kissy and Dana Beaton, and I am John Kissy. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Shauna Kim. You can continue the conversation online, listen to past episodes, and learn more about Western Worlds by going to our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. On behalf of everybody at Western Worlds, I would like to thank you for joining us. We hope you will join us next time here on Western Worlds.